All right. For the third time in four verses, he uses the word gar. And remember, when gar is used, it means I'm now giving you the reason and the cause and the explanation as to why we're doing this. This is the final conclusion of this section. And so he wants us to understand that judgment is without mercy, or merciless is actually literally what it says. It's got the alpha privative in front of mercy. So judgment is merciless to the person who shows no mercy. Now, what does that have to do with the rich man and the poor man? Because that's the context. That's how we started this section. The rich man comes in, a poor man comes in. How do we treat the poor man?
Terribly.
Without mercy, right? There's no mercy in the way he was treated. The fact that he treated the rich man well, if he was mercy, what would he have done to the poor man? He would have treated him well, because the reality is, who do we have more affinity with as Christians, rich men or poor men? We have a lot more affinity with the poor. And James makes the point that God chose the poor of this world to be rich in faith. Now, he didn't choose that in the sense of, I don't want any rich people because I don't like rich people. But as it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, when God saw through the wisdom that the world through its wisdom wouldn't know God, he chose through the foolishness of the message preached. And that meant what happened to the wisdom of the wise and the wisdom of the wealthy? They rejected it. So we have a situation here where, because the rich man was treated well, it left a wrong impression. When Christians who know the scriptures treat people a certain way, what's the conclusion the world makes about that treatment because they're Christians?
It's based on scripture.
Isn't that correct? Isn't that what they think? And so when the new denominations, when the denominations recently have still shown mercy on people who were unscripturally married, showed mercy on gay marriage, showed mercy on abortion and the people who have abortions and treated them like that was fine, what did the world conclude? Isn't that what they concluded? But what about us? See, since we don't do that, how do they conclude? Do they, oh, these are true Christians, is that what they say?
Hate.
No, now we're too judgmental. They're the ones with the mercy. So mercy has to be offered based on what?
Truth.
On the truth. And there's two verses I have in the middle of the page here that I wanted to focus on just for a couple minutes, because I want us to really appreciate this concept, and that is with the Old Testament prophets. Now, there's two prophets here. One's a prophetess. The second one is the prophetesses. But the first one is, but they're false, okay? If they had stood in my counsel and had caused my people to hear my words, then they should have turned them from their evil way and from their evil doings. And then the next verse, with lies you have made the heart of the righteous sad, whom I have not made sad. And you have strengthened the hands of the wicked, so that if he does not turn from his wicked way to save his life. Therefore you shall no longer envision futility nor practice divination, for I will deliver my people out of your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord. So the way, if we treat a rich man who's in other ways ungodly, in a special way, what conclusion is he going to draw? He's going to draw a conclusion that my life couldn't be all that bad, because look at how these Christians are treating me. What's the poor man going to conclude? I must be doing something wrong. And so judgment is without mercy. When we are not showing mercy, what we're showing is partiality and calling it mercy. The denominations are calling it mercy, but what has God said about what they're calling mercy? It's rebellion, right? It's rebellion. So we have to be very careful, and this sword cuts both ways, because sometimes in our quest to become righteous, we don't show mercy. So sometimes in our quest to be merciful, we're not righteous. And sometimes in our quest to be righteous, we're not merciful. Is either side better than the other? No, they're both terrible things to do. And so what we have to now consider, and like I say, that's what the GAR is telling me. The GAR is telling me we have to go back and we have to focus on the context. The context of this verse has to do with judging inappropriately. Judging based on, like Jesus said, if you love father or mother more than me, if you treat your father like he is not a sinner when he is a sinner, then what is that doing? That mercy? No, that's not mercy. And you will not be accorded any reward for showing mercy when it's not mercy. And so we have to really focus on this. If God says, for example, I've met people and you've met people, somebody leaves the church, they've fallen away, they're not here anymore, so we shouldn't withdraw from them because they've withdrawn from us and we're going to be merciful about it. They're not here anymore, so let's just forget it. Now, but what does the scripture say? Withdraw from every brother. So if we try to mask rebellion with mercy, what's going to happen? Then that's not going to get you what you want. And I believe that's contextually what we're dealing with here. And I'll show you a verse where Jesus does exactly the same thing with the Pharisees before we leave this section. But let's go back now. Once we understand that, and we're going to come back to it again when we get to this mercy triumphs over judgment, try to figure out exactly what that's dealing with. But for right now, let's talk about this mercilessness. Judgment is merciless. So if you go before God and you've shown no mercy, what does this verse say? There isn't going to be an iota of mercy. You're going to be judged by the strictest of the law. Anybody here want that? See, I don't want that. I want God to be as... I want to buy as much mercy as I can. How do I buy mercy? By showing mercy. All right? So, and Jesus basically, and I think this verse is really based on these two verses that are toward the middle of the page, a little bit under, where it says in verse 2, in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. And so, if I show mercy, if I measure it out abundantly, it'll be measured back to me abundantly. It's going to be measured. It's being measured. Every judgment I make during the course of my life is being measured. And the mean or average of that, when I stand before God on the judgment day, that's how I'm going to be judged. And so the more mercy I can manifest, but there's a line I can't cross. I can't cross the line of justice into mercy, nor can I cross the line of mercy into judgment. Because there's a very powerful border there. And so that's what we're going to talk about. Because as Jesus says in Matthew 23:23, right there toward the bottom of the page, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier provisions of the law, justice and mercy. All right? So blending these two together is a critical thing that we have to learn. And I've through the years, I've met Christians who are way too merciful, or they think it's merciful, because they're not being just. I've also met Christians who are so harsh in their judgments that they're not showing enough mercy. And of course, I'm perfect right in the middle, right? I'm trying to be. I mean, I've seen these people on both sides of the aisle, and then I've compared them to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and to Jesus, trying to find the fine line. Because let me tell you something, it gets a lot tougher than you think it is when it really comes down to it. So let's turn to page 2. And right at the top of the page, you just see the definition. It's everything that has anything to do with mercy, and then alpha is put in front of it. Just like anything to do with profit, and then I put un in front of it. What does that mean? If it's unprofitable, how much profit is there in it? None. So if it's from mercy to unmercy, or from mercy to mercy. In this case, as I say, whenever they have a vowel that goes in front of another vowel, they usually put an N in front of it. So in this case, Eleos, which is the Greek word for mercy, becomes aneleos, which is the alpha privative, as Strong points out, which means merciless, without mercy, without pity. And then the second definition is pertaining to the lack of mercy or the refusal to be merciful. So there's no way to misunderstand it. If I don't show the proper mercy at the proper time and in the proper way, what does God say? You're not going to get mercy. So is that a weightier matter then? Is that pretty important to you? Is that a heavy weight? Do you want to get your mercy right? I don't want to be guilty of taking the law not far enough. Because if I take the law not far enough and call it mercy, that's wrong. I don't want to take the law too far, because if I take it too far, then there's no mercy. So trying to figure that out. And we really struggle with this next clause. I spent, you can probably tell from the writings here, I spent quite a bit of time on that this afternoon, because I really did want to understand it. I've taught this for years, but I really wanted to take some time this afternoon and just really delve into it. What exactly does this word triumph, or the King James has rejoices, and the New Old American Standard has glory or glorieth, because the Greek word is boasting with kata in front of it. Now, kata means down. So we're boasting down. What exactly does boasting down mean? Well, you say the problem, there's two problems with this. The first one, let's see if I can find it. Where is it? Yeah, the very last definition. It's found only in biblical and Christian writings. So what is the Greek definition going to do for me? There isn't one. It's not used. This word was collected by God. But then, unfortunately, guess how many times it's used in Scripture? Only three times. Twice in James and once in Romans. So I kind of got a composite here. So let's just kind of go through this real quickly. Vines is the first definition, and he says that the kata is intensive, which means it makes it stronger. So it means to boast even more, or boast above and beyond something else. So I'm exulting over. I wish I'd put the verse in there. I didn't, but it's the one in Romans 11, where Paul tells the Gentiles, you're boasting over the branches. Branches were broken off so I could be put in. You're boasting over the branches that were broken off. And what does Paul say to do about that? You better be afraid. Because if God didn't spare the natural branches, he won't spare you either. And then it's used here in this sense. So the next definition by Thayer, to glory against, to exult over, to boast oneself to the injury of another thing. So putting down, making yourself greater so you can put something else down. So I'm smarter than you are, is this word. All right. Then Leonidas says, to have greater power or potential than. In other words, this time it's not a boast, it's reality. Because the word glory in the New Testament, sometimes it's used in a negative sense. He that glories, let him glory in the Lord. Is that wrong? No, that's a good thing. So boasting's not always wrong. I'm a Christian, and I'm better because I serve Jesus Christ. Is that boasting over something else? Well, it could be, but it shouldn't be. Now, the next one is to boast about something by downgrading something else. To boast against, to degrade. You must not boast, and in so doing, degrade the natural branches. So so let me just read this first paragraph. Regardless of whether we understand the term as boast, triumph, comparative superiority, or greater potential, it all works out to the same basic idea that mercy has a greater power and a greater significance than judgment under certain circumstances. Based on what? Based on, if I don't have any mercy, I won't give you. So mercy has a greater power than judgment. Well, in what way? Well, let's kind of kick it around a little bit. First of all, I just want to hit this concept because this one always struck me as interesting. If I witness a murder, and I come to you next Sunday morning and I say, last night I saw a murder, and this guy, I saw him kill this person, would any of you doubt that testimony? But what did God say in the Old Testament about the testimony of one witness?
No good.
Not enough. So God says, if you can't know for sure of the guilt, what do I want you to do? Let it go. Now, that's a very important concept. I won't call that mercy, but it's just a principle. Let me read that second verse on the bottom of page 2. One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. Now, why did God put that in here? Because a lot of innocent people are going to go free because he put that in here. Why did he put that in here?
Because more innocent people might be accused if you didn't have that law.
Okay, all right. So, I've always put it like this. If I'm wrong and I let somebody go who should have been punished, can God fix that later?
Yeah.
But if I'm wrong and that person shouldn't have been punished and I say, well, we don't want to let any guilty people slip through. So if a couple of innocent people get hurt, too bad. Does that sound pretty good? Well, depends on whether you're the innocent person or not, right?
Good it sounds.
But it's a temptation. It's a strong temptation. And it's, I think the undergirding of this whole concept of mercy is that we can't know. We can't always know. Some men's sins are evident. Some follow after. Don't know. I think you're as guilty as could be, but I can't prove it. So what do I do? Get up and preach against it? No, I let it go. So that's the undergirding here. Now, secondly, when situations arise where two laws collide, does that ever happen? Two laws collide? Yeah, it happens a lot. And so let's take a look. Remember Jesus. Jesus had a real struggle with this because how much mercy did those Pharisees have toward Jesus?
None.
All right, absolutely none. So here's one of the confrontations in Matthew chapter 12. Have you not read the law on the Sabbath? The priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and they're blameless. All right, so we have a law. If you work on a Sabbath day, you should be stoned. All right, what are the priests doing on the Sabbath day? Man, they're out there performing all the sacrifices and they're doing all the work. Well, wait a minute. Is there something wrong with that picture? I thought we weren't supposed to work on the Sabbath day. It's kind of like, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. But what if I decide I'm going to forsake the assembly because I'm above that? Then what would you say? Well, no, you can't do that. The assembly is the highest thing. And yet, well, never mind. Let's not go there because I don't want to get too far off of this. The point that Jesus is making, and notice what he says. If you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. All right? So who's the guiltless person? Jesus. But what have you done? You've condemned me. And you've condemned my disciples. And you've condemned some of these people. And so we have a law, the Sabbath day. We have another law. They've collided. Okay, here's another one. What man is there among you who has one sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath who will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Now, is that mercy for the sheep? Sorry, sheep, if it was Monday, I could get you out of there, but you're dead. I can't do anything about it till tomorrow morning. You're just going to have to stay there. But what did Jesus say about that? That's not what this law was meant to be. There is a law of mercy, and the Sabbath law has been mitigated or modified or changed slightly based on this other law. The next one. Look, why do they do what is not lawful on the Sabbath? But he said to them, have you not read what David did when he was in need and hungry, he and those with him? How he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest and ate the showbread, which is not lawful to eat except for the priests, and also gave some to those who were with him? And he said, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Then let's look at another one, and then I'll start making some applications. The next one is on top of page 3. I did one work, and you all marvel. Moses, therefore, gave you circumcision. So, circumcision and the Sabbath, are they contrary to each other? Well, what if you're born 8 days before the Sabbath day? And your day to be circumcised on the Sabbath, what should you do? Okay, if the Sabbath, now, but what did the Pharisees, what were the Sabbath the Pharisees affirming here? Now he's going to have to wait till the next day. Just like Jesus, you're going to have to wait for the next day. You can't do it on the Sabbath day. But you circumcise on the Sabbath day. So what we have is we have an unmerciful view of the Sabbath day. And the unmerciful view of the Sabbath day had been taken so far that they were saying Jesus is what? He's a sinner because he heals on the Sabbath day. So Jesus uses all of these statements. And then he makes an interesting statement in verse 24. Do not judge according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. So when it comes to situations where I can't know all the facts, where I'm the only witness, where I've got these two competing or two compelling commandments, and I'm not exactly sure how God would rule on it, what should I do? See, my natural inclination sometimes is to follow the Pharisees. I want to be right. So if I'm not exactly sure, just to be on the safe side, let's go ahead and do it. Well, wait a minute. What about that person over there? That person who you are impacting their life in a very negative way based on what? The possibility that it might be something that needs to be cared for. Now, most situations aren't in this situation, and so we don't have to worry about it. But when we get into delicate matters where there's information that isn't covered in the law itself, things that occurred that were not in the law itself, what should we do? Well, there's two answers. To be on the safe side, we should just keep chopping. The other answer is judgment's without mercy to him who shows no mercy. So when in doubt, when it comes to a law, if you're not absolutely 100% convinced that this situation fits into this law, then what should you do? Okay, here's another example in Mark chapter 7. And Jesus says at the very end there in verse 13, many such things you do. Well, what did they do? Well, they had a law, honor your father and mother. They had another law, if you make a vow to God, what should you do? You should pay it. All right, so I've made a vow to God. And now mom and dad fall into hard times. And I've got two conflicting laws. I have a law about a vow, and I have a law about taking care of my parents. What did the Pharisees say?
Sorry, parents.
Take care of God. What did Jesus say?
Take care of your parents.
That's a tradition of men. It's not in the scriptures. You've added that. You've added that, and you've made it so that if you make a vow, you have to keep the vow, and you can't take care of your parents. But what did God say about taking care of parents? But of course, they could counter, what did God say about taking care of the vow? Well, but Jesus said you had to add mercy. So I see a thread running through all of these. I see a thread running through if there's only one witness. If you have a law, the animal falls into the ditch on the Sabbath day, and you have a law of mercy and you have a law of judgment, which way should you go? What does Jesus say? Get that animal out of the ditch. You're right to do that. You have a law that says, now here's the one I really like because it fits right into the context of what we're dealing with. And that's this last verse, and that is, when the Pharisees saw it, they said to his disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? When Jesus heard that, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. So the Pharisees are doing the same thing to Jesus that this man did when the rich man and the poor man came into the congregation. They made a snap judgment based on their own preconceived attitudes towards certain things. And so as far as the Pharisees were concerned, and, you know, they basically said it, the people who don't know the law are cursed. So if you don't know what we know, you're just lowlifes. You're subhuman. We have no respect for you, no devout, no care, no concern for you. So when it came to the sinners, the harlots, the publicans, the wicked people, were they going to go eat with them and try to help them? Not a chance. They didn't care about them at all. So Jesus, when he's asked, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? Now, is that a slanderous statement? Is that what he was doing, eating with publicans and sinners? No, he was there to teach them. Eating was an ancillary thing. And I think the same thing is true today. If I have to go to a sinner's home in order to teach him the gospel versus the sinner has invited me into his home where I know I'm going to have to listen to all kinds of trashy stories and maybe I'll get an opportunity to teach the gospel, is that a little different situation? So we have to pick and choose. I mean, there's just landmines everywhere. There are landmines everywhere. We can't go too far. The Pharisees were falsely accusing our Lord and Savior of being a sinner, of violating the Sabbath day, based on a too harsh judgment. Yes, they could make their point. What did it say? The Sabbath day. Remember the Sabbath day. If you work on the Sabbath day, you should be put to death. But what did Jesus say? There's a component of mercy in this commandment that you need to understand. And yes, if I was out trying to make money on the Sabbath day, you'd have a valid case. But for me to be out doing acts of mercy on the Sabbath day, you don't have a valid case. So, you know, and we've wrestled with this. I'm just going to give you two examples of what I consider to be current day examples of this. The first one is this controversy right now that's going on about the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is an act that we are supposed to offer to brethren. Now, on Sunday evening, we've already taken it, and do we need to take it again? No. But the scriptures say in the old law, if you couldn't take the Passover meal because of a problem, you could take it again on the second of the month. Now, anybody else, and he's very clear there, but if you just wanted to work or do something else on the Sabbath day so you could take it on the second, then what does God say? Can't do that. So, to me, it is an act of mercy for us to offer the Lord's Supper on the evening assembly, because the people who are here need to take it. And yes, we're supposed to tarry for one another, and yes, we're all supposed to take it because we're all one. However, what about those people who can't take it in the morning? What should we do? Well, we can say, tough! Or we can say, well, we've got this precedent, and we're a merciful people, so we'll offer it. The second one is this problem we face with a father or a young girl or someone who's withdrawn from, and they have family responsibilities. And some brethren are out there saying, I don't care about the family responsibilities. If they're withdrawn from, that law is the law. And so I think they're making the same mistake as Matthew 15 and Mark 7. But if if my father's withdrawn from, has a heart attack, and the doctor says, look, he needs 24-hour care, you're going to have to take him into your home. Well, there's some brethren out there who would say what?
Don't do it.
You can't take him in your home. Now, is that merciful? No. Do we have a law that could justify it? Well, yeah, we have a law that could justify it, but I'm not going to do it. Now, I have to live with my conscience, and like I said, is mercy more important or judgment more important?
Mercy.
Okay, I'm going to be merciful here, because I've already got some precedents. I got the precedent of Matthew 15 and Mark 7 at the precedent of Jesus. And so, and there's lots of other examples out there like this, situations where it doesn't fit the rules. In other words, there's a law. Does every situation fit that law? Now, it's close, but how close does it need to be? Well, I guess it depends on how much mercy you have. And that's where we get into a struggle, and that's where we run into a problem. But if mercy triumphs over judgment, what does the Lord prefer for me to do in situations where it doesn't quite fit it, but I'm not sure what to do, and I want to be right with God, and I'd feel better if I just did what the law said, but it doesn't really fit it? So it's kind of like the one witness versus two witness situation to me. And so maybe I'm a lot more merciful than some people would be on certain things. And you would say, well, I don't really understand why Alan is so hard and so fast on these other things, but he seems to get mushy on this. Well, whenever you see me getting mushy, it's because there's a mercy component there, and there's something that's just not quite exactly what was involved in the initial command, and I don't know what to do with it. And we could go ahead and do it anyway, but what if we're wrong? Virgil, I saw your hand come up.
No, that's okay.
So we took the whole class on that. I think this is important because we all struggle with it. We are members of the church, and as members of the church, we know how critical law is and how strongly law has to be upheld. And in that respect, we, similar to the Pharisees, what we don't want to do is fall into the trap of the Pharisees. The trap of the Pharisees was they didn't know when to let go. They didn't know when to just leave it and say, okay, now mercy takes over, and I don't have to legislate here. I don't have to write all these little rules and regulations that God didn't quite cover. If God didn't put them there, what should I do? Leave it alone. Don't write a bunch of traditions. Jesus said many things like this you're doing. So the issue here is when we don't know, we need to be merciful. Because mercy triumphs over judgment. Mercy boasts over judgment. Mercy is better than judgment. When you don't know for sure, you're better off to be merciful than you are to judge harshly. Because like I said, can God fix it? See, God can fix it if I'm too merciful. But if I'm too harsh, what's going to happen to my judgment? It's going to be dialed back. I'm not going to get the mercy that I want. And so, now, if the Lord hadn't wanted us to see it this way, I don't know why he would have put all these verses in here telling us that judgment is without mercy if you don't show mercy, and that mercy triumphs over judgment, and that the way you judge, and then to see all of these battles between Jesus and the Pharisees over all of these different things where they were too harsh, and he was being merciful, and his mercy was considered what by the Pharisees? Proof that he was soft on the law. Proof that he was a sinner. Now, as I say, we have to be careful here because if you go too far with that, then where do you end up? You end up with lawlessness. But this is a point, a rubbing point, that we really need to look at. And when we find ourselves in situations where we have to decide, am I going to go to the side of mercy? Am I going to err to the side of mercy or err to the side of judgment? What does the Lord want every time? Err to the side of mercy. And so this again is a very complicated subject. And so I hope that we've clarified it. You can read through the scriptures a little more and think about it. If you have any more questions, we can deal with them at the beginning of class next week. But I really think this is something we all have to wrestle with because there's so many scriptures in here dealing with this. Brian?
Yeah, and it's interesting how sometimes when people show mercy, they think that you're okay with sin, right? And so I think about like the woman that was brought to Jesus who had been caught in adultery. And of course we all know he says, you know, you who was without sin cast the first stone. They all went away, but he didn't let her off the hook, right? He said go and sin no more. However, he did show her mercy. She was deserving of death, and whoever she was with was deserving of death,
right?
He showed mercy but still made it known the sin wasn't acceptable.
Yeah. And that was exactly the situation we're just talking about, because when he said you cast the first stone, who had to cast the first stone? The witnesses. If the witnesses wouldn't cast the first stone, and Jesus said, did anyone condemn you? Well, then what can he do? He knows he's guilty, but what can he do by the law? He has to let it go. So, exactly. We're in the exact same set of circumstances, but how did the Pharisees feel about that? I'm sure they were madder than hornets, but what could they do? He had them. He had them. All right. Thanks, Brian. We'll go ahead and stop there. And we'll pick up next week in verse 14. unless, as I say, anybody has any more questions on this. But I wanted to do it in a class form. I've been wanting to do this for a while, but in a sermon format, you can kind of, people can kind of misunderstand it and they can't ask questions. So I just wanted to make sure that we had the opportunity. All right. Thanks, everybody.